I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, podcast and conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Lorna Bracewell, assistant professor of political science at Flagler College. We're discussing her 2021 book, Why We Lost the Sex Wars, Sexual Freedom in the Me Too Era, from the University of Minnesota Press. Her scholarship focuses on feminist theory and history of political thought, and has been published in academic journals such as Science, Journal of Women in Culture and Society, and popular forums like the Washington Post. So, first of all, Lorna Bracewell, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lorna, I love the book. This is a, you know, it's a great tour through history of feminism in the last 30, 40 years, especially its these sort of internecine struggles that you see, but also its relationship to liberalism, which I'm looking forward to discussing all these issues and the kind of some of the contemporary implications of your view, which I found fascinating. So congratulations on the book. And let me ask, first of all, what was the motivation for writing the book in the first place?
So I have like buried in a footnote somewhere in the book, something that should probably not be buried in a footnote, but I quote at length this passage from an essay by Eve Sedgwick, the kind of foundational, you know, queer theorist. And she kind of coins this notion of Christmas effects. I won't try to imitate her inimitable prose, but you know, it's something to the effect of like, there's something so sad about the Christmas season because all the institutions kind of line up and speak in one voice. There's a kind of monotony and a kind of monochromatic dullness to it when, you know, the church is saying the same thing as the commercial sector is saying the same thing as the politicians and the, you know, academic calendar, right? All these things are kind of lined up in this way that's kind of tedious and boring. And I was kind of having that Christmas effects kind of experience when I looked at the landscape of contemporary feminist sexual politics. I was just hearing, you know, 1,000 variations on our, you know, kind of old liberal arguments about privacy and individual expression and speech. And I just felt like there must be something else to say about sexual injustice, sexual oppression, and how to respond to it. And so that was kind of the motivation for the project, is for me to kind of rifle through the feminist past to just find feminists saying something different, anything different, right? And I feel like I really found that in spades during the feminist sexuality debates of the 1970s and 1980s. And so I really wrote the book to try to foreground these older, I think richer ways of thinking about sexual politics for feminists today.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, you start the book by talking about the Me Too movement and the kinds of, you know, backlash that it has engendered, and you know, specifically on the left, which is interesting, sort of sex positive feminists. And I was wondering if you maybe could start there and just say a little bit about just the Me Too movement and the kind of the way in which the way you put it, the catfight narrative, I guess, which is, you know, cheeky way of putting it, the catfight narrative, which is a narrative that you find to be a caricature, but it's one that's sort of exerted some influence on the way in which feminists have come into conflict about issues around sex. So maybe you could start sort of with the Me Too movement and you know, kind of frame the way we can get into this sort of central narrative that you take apart in the book.
Sure. So yeah, I kind of greeted the arrival of the Me Too hashtag with a lot of like enthusiasm, as I think a lot of feminists did. Because to me, that was a kind of disruption of that boring, tedious, repetitive kind of Christmas effects experience that I was having of feminist sexual politics. Here were feminists like, you know, decrying sexual harassment, sexual abuse, sexual injustice, right? And saying something other than a kind of facile, like I have the right to do what I want in private with my body or something like that. So I was kind of, you know, excited at, you know, the potentially really radical critique of the sexual political status quo that Me Too represented. But of course, it like immediately became apparent the limitations of that kind of intervention, right? The voices that were being amplified were of, you know, a kind of narrow subset of women, even though the hashtag itself had been kind of pioneered by, you know, this woman of color, anti-violence activist, Tarana Burke, years and years before the hashtag went viral. And the reason the hashtag went viral was because, you know, white celebrity American women found some utility in it. So it wasn't really doing the work of highlighting the kind of broad spectrum of sexual harassment and sexual injustice that is perpetrated today. It was, you know, focused on this kind of narrow segment of that. And those limitations were like pointed out right immediately by, you know, smart, perceptive feminist critics. That critique seemed apt to me and well-placed. There were some other critiques that began to emerge that I didn't find quite as apt or well-placed, right? I'm thinking of like the open letter that Catherine Deneuve, wrote and co-signed by, you know, other kind of culturally similarly placed celebrity women, which kind of was saying, oh, the Me Too, it's a kind of moral panic and it's going to be the death knell of sexual liberty and romance and that like erotic frisson that comes from, you know, whatever conventional heterosexual courtship, I don't know, you know, some version of that, right? That there's something kind of puritanical and blue nose-ish about the kind of Me Too, like it's a kind of pearl clutching hysteria, right? That's not feminist. And there were a bunch of other versions, you know, Margaret Atwood, kind of published a not all together dissimilar critique of Me Too, likening it to the Casa Nostra, which really took me, aback, right? To say that it kind of has these like totalitarian implications and what have you. That was a kind of vein of feminist criticism that emerged alongside Me Too. And I found that really unpersuasive. And I found it fascinating that like Catherine Deneuve and, Margaret Atwood and these, you know, kind of feminist voices ostensibly on the kind of progressive cultural left were saying the same things about Me Too that, you know, David French and Mona Charon and these conservatives were saying in like venues like the National Review, right? They were, you know, saying that Me Too posed this threat to kind of civil liberties and due process. And, you know, so I found that kind of convergence troubling. And I wanted to kind of unpack why, how did that come to be, right? And to understand that or to answer that question, I had to go back to the history of the feminist sex wars and how that history has been kind of misrepresented and misunderstood and misconstrued along the lines of what I call the catfight narrative, which is that the sex wars were this like, you know, two-sided debate between pro-sex and anti-sex feminists. And fortunately, the white hat pro-sex feminists won, and those, you know, old biddy pearl-clutching puritanical anti-sex feminists have been consigned to the dustbin of history where they belong. And now we're all, you know, we all celebrate our individual right to have whatever kind of sex we want in private. That was sort of the moral that I took to be secreting from this catfight narrative representation of the sex wars. And I saw that narrative as really limiting feminist sexual politics today and producing that kind of knee-jerk, you know, Margaret Atwood, Catherine Deneuve, whatever, you know, kind of feminist critique of Me Too. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, I mean, and you very much can see it in the backlash, which I mean, I'd be interested in your take on where things stand now, since it's been you know, it's funny, we write these books and then they come out like a year later and the world changes a little bit. So,
yeah, I mean, majorly. And it's funny for me too, because like, you know, when I wrote this as a dissertation, I hadn't really connected it to the politics of Me Too or anything like that. And I think because like Me Too hadn't happened yet, if I'm thinking of the timeline, right? So then when I'm like shopping it around as a book project, you know, my publisher is like, well, wow, you should maybe like connect this to the big, you know, sexual reckoning we're undergoing. And that was going to be like the edgy contemporary hook. And of course, then the book comes out and, you know, like there's a global pandemic and there's this, you know, the Black Lives Matter uprising of last summer, and all that seems so remote, right?
Right. Well, we're also living through, you know, the sort of the backlash in terms of the on the set, the Dave Chappelle special has come out recently,
gosh.
And you know, so the backlash, we've come full backlash. So, I mean, your account of the current state seems to me to be to be right, and so in need of the kind of as you put it, a kind of history of the present to try to figure out how we got here, and then what you know, how that kind of account of the history is limiting our options today, yeah. which is interesting. So maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, I mean, are you able to say just in general, we'll get into it, but what the problem is with that framing of the history as a kind of catfight, and how we should think about it differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big problem with that framing is it just leaves so much of what was said and done by feminists during this period totally out of the picture, right? Just sort of invisibilizes that stuff. And now I think that stuff is really rich and provocative and important, right? And, you know, I'm thinking primarily of the contributions to the sex wars of third world women of color, right? The catfight narrative framing, which says, you know, there were like these good feminists who were fun and liked sex and liked porn and wanted us all to have the right to do whatever we wanted in private and to express whatever ideas about sex we wanted to, who were battling, again, these like kind of conservative, you know, authoritarian Puritan feminists, you know, that framing just, it makes it seem as if, you know, people like who I discuss in the book, like Alice Walker, like Tareem Moraga, like never intervened in these debates, which of course they did. you know, so you can't map the interventions in the sex wars of these feminists of color onto that tidy dichotomous schema. And that's a huge problem because it invisibilizes their interventions in feminist sexual politics that I think are really valuable, particularly for us right now, as, you know, kind of carceral responses to sexual injustice are increasingly ascendant. So that's one limitation the catfight narrative imposes on us. Yeah, I think another limitation, it just totally misrepresents and misapprehends what feminist critics of pornography, for example, were saying, and then what feminist defenders of pornography, for example, were saying. The feminist critics of pornography, anti-pornography feminists like Catherine MacKinnon, like Andrea Dworkin, they were not saying what conservative critics of pornography have said for like ever. you know, their argument was not that pornography deviated from traditional patriarchal sexual values, and that's why it has to be controlled and suppressed. That's what conservatives think, right? Pornography represents a kind of sexual perversion that has to be contained lest it, you know, destroy the kind of sexual social fabric that holds civilization together, right? Feminist critics of pornography were obviously not saying that. They have no interest in defending kind of patriarchal convention, right, in the way that conservatives do. Their argument was that pornography constituted a political harm to women, that it undermined their claim to equal citizenship. And this was why pornography had to be regulated, right? So that's like one important difference. There are more differences between the kind of conservative analysis of pornography and the feminist analysis of pornography. Conservatives want to use criminal obscenity law to kind of rein in the subversive threat of pornography, whereas the feminist critics of pornography had no interest in using extant criminal obscenity law, which they thought was like deeply patriarchal and bad for women. And this is why they kind of, I'm thinking of Catherine McKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, tried to come up with their kind of civil rights approach to pornography regulation, which, you know, say what you want about it, you don't have to think it was a good approach, but it was different from what conservatives traditionally had wanted to do. So anyway, there's these important distinctions that get totally papered over by the catfight narrative. On the pro-sex feminist side, there's a lot the catfight narrative leaves out of the picture there. So the catfight narrative would have us think that the feminist defenders of pornography were kind of speaking in a liberal idiom, right? They were speaking out in favor of freedom of expression, freedom of sexual expression, that they were speaking out in favor, you know, they had a kind of anti-censorship position, right? Kind of rooted in a kind of sense of the public and private divide and what is an appropriate exercise of state power and what is a kind of overstepping of the proper bounds of state power. Right? The catfight narrative would have us think that that was the kind of argument that pro-sex feminist defenders of pornography were making. Well, if you go back and you look at, you know, what they actually said and did, they were in a whole different conceptual universe than that, right? They were critics of notions like the right to privacy. They saw that as a kind of oppressive sexual norm. This idea that you can have whatever kind of sex you want as long as it's private. They saw that as like deeply anti-sex, deeply anti-woman. And they wanted to contest it, right? I think of, I have this great quote from then Pat, now Patrick Califia, you know, who says like, you know, something like, I won't be satisfied until I'm free to be as, you know, kind of kinky in the street as I am in my dungeon, right? So, you know, when they're talking about sexual freedom, they don't mean a kind of freedom to do what you want in private. They mean a kind of robust, public, communal sexual freedom. So anyway, those are just some examples, right? I think the kind of nuance, sophistication, and importantly, like difference from the kind of mainstream liberal conceptions that get papered over and occluded by the catfight narrative.
Right. Yeah. That strikes me. I mean, reading your book, there are a lot more similarities between the anti-pornography feminists and the sex radical feminists than differences in some ways, right? So you know, this sort of a constructivist view of gender that's shared between them, and sort of politicization of the private, you know, an anti-liberal, you know, at least a critique of a liberalism at a deep level. I don't know if you want to, you know, expand on that, but it strikes me that, you know, at least part of what's going on here is that the catfight narrative is kind of liberal narrative. That is, it posits a pro-liberal side and an anti-liberal side, whereas it turns out that actually both sides are not, you know, are critics of liberalism and so share much more in common than you might expect.
Yeah, it is. It's a kind of liberal triumphalist account, right? That's so like ironic because, of course, like at the time, as you point out, the sex radicals and the anti-porn feminists, they were bitter foes, there's no doubt. They also had a lot in common. And their most bitter opponents were not each other, but civil libertarian liberals, right? Who viewed anti-pornography feminists as kind of censorious prudes, the same censorious prudes they've been fighting for years and years, right? Just in a kind of new, dangerous, seductive feminist guise, right? And then, you know, on the sex radical side, they found all this, you know, kind of talk about a kind of robust public sexual freedom, you know, to be quite scandalizing, right? And, you know, I was really surprised as I was doing the research for the book. I was looking at, you know, what the feminist parties were saying, but also what liberals were saying at the time. And, you know, you look at kind of pro-sex libertarians like a Hugh Hefner, and his whole rationale for narrowing the category of obscenity to allow for the publication of more sexually explicit speech, his whole argument was that that would ultimately lead to less sexual perversion, that, you know, allowing the free circulation of a publication like Playboy would shore up the norms of kind of conventional heterosexuality and make the world a less freaky, kinky place, right? Which was, of course, exactly not what sex radical feminists wanted. They wanted to contest heteronormativity, as we would say today, and allow a kind of much broader expression of human sexual potential to be manifest. So, you know, liberals and civil libertarians were not on board with that project. I don't even know why I started talking about all that, but the catfight narrative makes us unable to kind of see all of that. So much is lost.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that there, you know, I mean, you know, just on the issue of pornography, right? That the, you know, both sides have a common enemy in a way, which is sort of inequality or subordination or domination through the graphic display of sex. And presumably both sides, right, the sort of anti-pornography side and the pro-pornography side would be, you know, would find perfectly acceptable a depiction, maybe it would be utopian for one side, but I don't know, the depiction of sex that is actually, you know, egalitarian, right? So, sure. I mean, there's so much kind of, you know, talking past one another because they have a similar target, right?
Yeah. And, you know, it's easy to kind of armchair quarterback from the perch of the present and, you know, kind of say, oh, you could have gotten together on this. And, you know, there's obviously historical reasons that they did not see it that way. But I think it's important to not, as the catfight narrative invites us to do, kind of fixate on what divided them to the point that we lose sight of what united them ultimately.
Right. Yeah. And Monday morning quarterback, I guess there's a word, but mainly to bring up that, you know, that it is surprising in a way that history turned in that way. And it makes me, you know, I'm interested in you developing exactly why history didn't turn out in that way, that there was much more unanimity than divergence. But so let's talk about that history, because you discuss it in the substance of the book. And, you know, by talking the first couple chapters about the sort of anti-pornography feminists, and third chapter about the sex radical feminists, and then in the fourth chapter, you know, contributions from feminists of color and third world feminists. And so I want to talk about all those, you know, great discussions here. So just talk about the first two chapters on the anti-pornography feminists. The first chapter, you talk about the emergence of that group that was in reaction, large part to a kind of, you know, a new form of liberalism, or what I think of as kind of form of libertarianism, really, that emerged in the post-war period, that sort of challenged censorship that based on the obscenity laws that you discussed, that, you know, the Hugh Hefner, right, again, the Hugh Hefner form of libertarianism basically says that, you know, pornography doesn't cause any harm, right? It's a private choice of individuals, or however you want to, you know, discuss the argument. It's part of the freedom of individual expression, and so shouldn't be censored. So maybe you could just discuss the emergence of anti-pornography feminists, you know, however you want to discuss McKinnon and Dworkin, and, you know, how they, you would put their arguments in contrast to the way the usual narrative has it.
Sure. Yeah. So I think anti-pornography feminism has to be understood as a kind of reaction against this liberal project that really starts in earnest in the 1950s. You have figures like Barney Rossett, the publisher at Growth Press. They set out with a kind of team of attorneys, Charles Rimbar, you know, a couple other names I can mention, but And their goal is to chip away at the category of obscenity. They want to argue into the law a kind of narrower way of construing that category to allow for the publication of Rosset starts with things like Lady Chatterley's Lover, right? And you know, you're sort of like highbrow, I guess, literary obscene things. And you know, in a series of Supreme Court decisions, I think the Roth decision is pivotal here, they succeed. And obscenity is defined in such a way that exemptions are made for works that have, you know, like artistic value and literary value, works that cater to something other than a prurient interest. Right.
And this is based on First Amendment decision.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, these legal changes happen in terms of how the First Amendment is interpreted and applied to sexually explicit material. And the result is, right, this renaissance, if you will, of sexually explicit publishing. And in terms of literature, but also in terms of film, right? So works that had previously been kind of taboo or even black market, and people who would have been prosecuted for trafficking in those works right now, they're permitted to. So you get the kind of emergence of a much more robust public market in kind of sexually explicit things. And, you know, so there's this tremendous cultural shift that kind of culminates in, you know, what historians describe as this moment of like porno chic, right, in the 70s, where like Jackie O goes to see Deep Throat, right? And it's all very kind of, you know, a little edgy and, but mainstream, right? A kind of way to signal your sophistication or something by participating in this. And this is all wrapped up too in like the kind of values of the sexual revolution and what have you. So anti-pornography feminists, I think, are responding to these changes. And, you know, they view these changes as ultimately kind of not only for the good, right? They see the kind of sexual revolution as a kind of reprogramming of patriarchy, right? And they see this kind of new efflorescence of pornographic material as, you know, as they put it, a kind of propaganda for male dominance and supremacy that kind of undermines women's claim to equal citizenship and status. So, yeah, I mean, that's what they understand themselves to be doing, is like taking on this liberal juggernaut and offering a kind of alternative analysis of the relationship of sex, sexuality, sexual expression to politics and justice and equality and things like that. Does that answer? I forget.
Yeah. No. I mean, that's good. In a way, I'm curious is sort of, I guess speaking as a liberal myself, I find the kind of the approach of, you know, the liberalism as it's described in this chapter to be somewhat of a flat notion of liberalism, which it is. I mean, liberalism is capacious, and it's unfortunate that there was such a sort of flattening in this period of the notion of liberalism. So I'm curious,
liberals eventually come out to
people like Cass Sunstein sort of develop this further. I mean, I'm curious in a way, you know, about, you know, is the view of Dworkin or McKinnon the concern that, you know, the liberal or libertarian view is sort of in principle it's not targeting the right thing, right? Its target is about harm, say per se, and it should be about subordination or domination. That is, it like sort of in principle, it's limited. It's not targeting the right kind of
in a way,
society, injustice in society.
Their critique is very much of a piece of, you know, very familiar, I think, feminist critiques of liberalism, that like its conceptual infrastructure was developed to address the problems and oppressions and limitations experienced by a kind of narrow group of people, right? Like kind of propertied, you know, men, often white and European, And now, obviously, the goal is to extend those kind of liberal slate of rights and protections to people who historically were not imagined to be encompassed in that universe. And it's a challenge because it turns out that, you know, people who are kind of differently socially, economically, culturally situated have kind of different needs, experience different forms of domination. And like liberalism is just not very well suited to address those. So yeah, sexual harm or the kind of harm produced by, you know, sexual subordination would be an example that they might point to say like, look, like it's not really like, you know, being raped is not really like having your property stolen, right? And there is no precedent in kind of liberal legal frameworks for naming the harm experienced by, like, you know, a victim of rape, for example. And what we have though is like a kind of history of punishing rape like we do other property crimes, right? So anyway, that's just kind of one example where, you know, feminists would say there's real limitations to liberalism's ability to respond to these new demands by these historically excluded groups. And for Dworkin and McKinnon, the harm caused by pornography is another example of one of those harms.
That's good. I mean, so first question was about principle, you know, the difference of principle here. I mean, the second is, I think it speaks to this, what you were just saying, which is about the, I guess the policy means to address the harms, right? And I mean, you could say a little bit about the, you know, you mentioned before the sort of civil rights approach of McKinnon. I'm not sure, probably a lot of people listening to this are going to be familiar with that account. I mean, I'm curious, you know, in a way, I mean, what's, you know, maybe you could say a little bit about it to remind us, but also if that's, if you think of that as sort of the dominant sort of policy approach to combating this particular issue in the case of anti-pornography feminists, or are there other,
there were other
options?
There were definitely other, you know, yeah. They did a lot of boycotts. They did a lot of direct action, kind of grassrootsy things. Some of it quite colorful, right? They would kind of do stakeouts in front of, you know, because this is back in the old days when if you wanted to view pornography, you had to go to a specific brick and mortar location to purchase it or to put a nickel in a Nickelodeon or whatever and watch the reels. So they would kind of do these stakeouts in front of these adult shops, and they would, you know, take pictures, right, of the men, you know, who were kind of coming and going, and they would distribute, right, the kind of pictures and names of, you know, people who were frequented these shops. And, you know, in some cases, I mean, they engaged in acts of, you know, terrorism, right? They would, you know, do sabotage and, you know, kind of throw pig's blood, right? You know, on the storefronts or even in the stores. They would lead pornography tours. This is something that Women Against Pornography did in Times Square, where, you know, they would take interested, concerned citizens on tours of the kind of red light district there and, you know, kind of gawk at whatever there was to gawk at. So yeah, they would do other stuff. Dworkin and McKinnon developed this kind of civil rights approach, and it became the kind of, you know, more formal policy kind of response. And yeah, the idea, it was based on the work McKinnon had done, pioneering work on sexual harassment, right? In the same way that, you know, sexual harassment in the workplace is, you know, conceptualized as a harm insofar as it kind of contributes to the unequal status and the subordination of women. And is therefore, you know, subject to civil litigation, companies that can be demonstrated, you know, kind of engage in these acts of sexual harassment in a kind of systematic way can, you know, be taken to court and sued and forced to pay damages to victims. The idea was that, you know, we would kind of approach the regulation of pornography in the same way. So a plaintiff who, you know, believed that they had experienced some kind of civil harm as a result of a particular piece of pornography, they could, you know, sue the producer, the seller of that piece of pornography for damages, right? And there would be a kind of civil proceeding that would occur to determine, you know, liability and all those sorts of things. So that was the idea with the civil rights approach, but anti-pornography feminists, you know, that was not their exclusive focus. It did come to kind of predominate. And there's a great book, not my book is great too, everyone should read it, but communication scholar Carolyn Bronstein has a just magisterial history of the anti-pornography feminist movement that really goes into detail about all these kind of alternative, kind of more grassroots approaches that anti-pornography feminists embraced as well.
Yeah, what do you think about, I mean, so liberals or libertarians kind of shot back against the sort of McKinnon type of policy approach.
Oh yeah, they were not initially on board.
right, yes, exactly, right. Well, in part, I suppose one could see why. I mean, somebody like Nadine Strossen, you know, argues that, you can say that, you know, pornography harms you in a civil rights sense, why not say the Bible harms you or Homer harms you, and you can take sort of civil rights action against, you know, X, Y, and Z bookstore. And so we're on a sort of slippery slope argument. I was curious about what you, I mean, number one, kind of what you make of those criticisms, but also number two, how powerful or effective they were in the time.
Yeah, so they were super powerful and effective. I mean, that's Judge Easterbrook, the federal court judge, because I should say this ordinance, this model ordinance, Dworkin and McKinnon concocted while they're teaching a course at the University of Minnesota. And they convinced the city council there in Minneapolis to take up a version of it. The city council passes it. It's vetoed by the mayor there, Don Frazier, and he cites kind of conventional libertarian objections, you know, like you've just, the slippery slope kind of arguments and stuff. Other municipalities across the country kind of consider it. It is ultimately passed into law in one place and signed into law in Indianapolis. And that version gets challenged in court by the American Booksellers Association, but a whole panoply of, you know, people who you would assume would, you know, want to battle, you know, against this sort of thing. And ultimately those arguments prove decisive. And Judge Easterbrook, who's the circuit court judge who writes the ruling, finds the ordinance unconstitutional on First Amendment grounds. Those kind of conventional civil libertarian arguments prove very powerful, very potent, very persuasive, to the point that the ordinance becomes, you know, by the late 1980s, a dead letter, right, of purely kind of philosophical interest. And it turns out like a lot of philosophical interest, because, you know, liberal philosophers and legal theorists really kind of get on board after the political battle is over, and actually come to see a lot of potential in McKinnon's approach. And then I think another part of your question was kind of like, what do I make of the Dworkin McKinnon?
Yeah, well, I mean, I put it in this way. I mean, if, you know, part of your project is to think about the present. Yeah. And I would say if, you know, if one were to bring back something like, you know, this sort of policy approach, would you expect things to be different this time around in terms of the sort of a liberal response to it? Or would it be able to, you know, reconceptualize the policy in such a way that it might get more traction?
You know, I don't know. In some ways, I feel like our present isn't all that different from the 1980s in respect to the hegemony of, and the kind of prevalence for like a kind of knee-jerk libertarianism in American political culture. But I don't, you know, who knows? I will say that I don't think it would, you know, I don't think it would make a whole world of difference, right? I think that some of the critics of the ordinance, right, who were like, oh, this is going to have such a chilling effect, and I think that those people just like totally overestimate the power of this kind of civil rights approach, right? I mean, like, companies, colleges, universities can all be held liable for sexual harassment right now. Is there less sexual harassment now than there you know, was before this regime of civil liability was initiated. You know, the Me Too movement would lead one to think maybe not. So I don't know that it would. Anti-pornography feminists really obviously believed that this legislation would have a huge transformational impact. And its opponents, in a way, agreed with them. If this were to become law, they thought it would have all these devastating effects. But I, you know, my kind of thought is like, shrug emoji. I don't know that it would matter all that much.
Yeah, good. I'm going to go into the next chapter because this, you know, you take up the, you know, the changing mind of the liberal, you know, in a way, the sort of transformation of liberalism towards pornography and the, what, I guess in the 80s and the 90s, with figures like Cass Sunstein or Martha Nussbaum, you know, altering liberalism's stance towards pornography in particular, you know, recognizing some of the arguments that, you know, MacKinnon or Dworkin would make. But I take it, you know, don't go all the way to, is the issue, you know, is the difference between a Sunstein and a Dworkin and a MacKinnon the difference over principle? Or would you say it's a difference over sort of the policy prescription or both?
I think it's both, you know, because the kind of model ordinance that Andrea Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon proposed was very broad. It would have applied to a, you know, really broad set of materials. And, you know, you can see like the more kind of maybe pragmatic liberal proponents of something like a Dworkin-MacKinnon ordinance, right? You can just kind of see them like pulling their hair out, right? Like if you would just more narrowly tailor the category, the regulable category of materials here, this could have a better kind of chance at passing First Amendment muster, right? And that's exactly what, you know, Cass Sunstein proposes to be done, to only focus on violent pornography, for example. Whereas Dworkin and MacKinnon, I mean, they are emphatic, like on principle, no, they will not narrow the scope in that way because they believe that Playboy is just as detrimental to the kind of civil rights and status of women as, you know, whatever, you know, kind of niche BDSM publication Sunstein has, you know, in his mind's eye as he's narrowing the scope, right? They want to reach it all because they think it all has this kind of pernicious political effect. So I think in there it's a difference of both policy and principle, because the difference in policy reflects a kind of difference in principle. I think Sunstein is not quite persuaded that Playboy does any harm, whereas Dworkin and MacKinnon absolutely are. I think too, right, Sunstein wants to use existing obscenity law, basically, or, you know, Elena Kagan maybe would be a better example of that, right? It's like, how can we repurpose the criminal regime of obscenity to address this feminist concern that it was never really designed to address, but how can we kind of make criminal obscenity law do this work? You know, whereas again, like Dworkin and MacKinnon, they were just on principle opposed to a criminal approach to, I mean, they saw the kind of criminal justice arm of, but they saw the whole state, right, as like deeply patriarchal. And MacKinnon likes civil rights law because she views it as empowering the people as opposed to the patriarchal state. So, you know, there's another kind of difference in policy that I think is produced by a difference in principle. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think of pretty recently, Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times has sort of yeah. revived that liberal critique sure. of pornography against Pornhub and the sort of connection with sex, because the idea is right. You know, I don't remember if you have his article in the front of your mind, but his shtick was basically to argue, you know, I'm not against pornography per se. I'm against pornography that does, you Absolutely. Know, clear harm and violence to women, as in the case of
and there was a trafficking provision in Dworkin and MacKinnon's model ordinance, but it was just that, a provision in a much broader law, right? Whereas, you know, a Nick Kristof wants to you know, if material, if sexually explicit material was produced non-consensually, you know, Christoph wants there to be a kind of criminal penalty for the people who produced that. Whereas, you know, that's just a narrower project than what Dworkin and McKinnon were doing.
Yeah. So is your sense here that, I mean, the sort of upshot of the argument that, you know, liberals are able then in the 80s and 90s to say, look, we've taken the truth of the McKinnon and Dworkin view and disposed of what's, you know, I guess, you know, oppressive to liberalism. And so we can then march ahead in history. And so that sort of liberal triumphalism is able to be redeemed, so we can cast off what was sort of benighted about that previous view. Is that your sense?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. All the while, right, McKinnon is like fulminating, right, saying like, no, like, this is not what I was trying to do, you know, but the train has left the station, right?
Yeah, that's great. Well, so I want to turn over to the other side of the aisle, I guess, in the sense of to turn your next chapter in talking about the sex radical feminists and their emergence, and then again, the way in which they, well, in this case, they're not sort of appropriated by liberalism, I guess, in the way that the anti-pornography feminists were, but they allied themselves with feminism against the anti-pornography feminists. This is the part of the story that I mentioned before. I'm curious about how this actually happened, because again, I mean, it strikes me that, you know, this seems like a little bit of a pact with the devil, right? On the part of the sex radical feminists. Why would you do this? Why would you ally yourself with these liberal folks if you have such fundamental disagreements with them and
they
much more in common?
They want to win.
Okay. All right. Okay. So maybe you could just walk us through like sort of where the sex radical feminists came from and then sort of why they allied themselves with the liberals.
Yeah. So, you know, sex radical feminism, I think you have to understand it in the broader context of, you know, kind of gay liberation and women's liberation in the 1960s. They too are part of a kind of feminist critique of the sexual revolution, which they viewed as deeply patriarchal and therefore limited, right? The sexual revolution expanded the scope of sexual freedom for men, but it did not do so for women. And sex radical feminists wanted, as they put it themselves, a sexual revolution that is not sexist, right? So that was a part of what they were kind of responding to. They were also, I think, you know, like kind of gay liberation was too, responding to the real limitations of kind of liberal civil libertarian defenses of sexual freedom, right? They wanted more than a kind of right to gather unmolested by police in, you know, mafia-run gay bars or whatever, right? They wanted to kind of come out of the closets and into the streets, right? In the language of gay liberation, I think that same kind of ethos permeates sex radical feminist politics, right? They did not want a right to privacy. They wanted a right to kind of realize to the fullest extent in the context of a robust sexual community, their kind of polymorphous perversity, right? So they were, you know, I think of Pat Califia, then Pat, now Patrick Califia, writing these op-eds responding to various liberal anti-censorship efforts, right? And, you know, in the pages of like The Advocate, Patrick Califia is just taking these liberals to task for like not going far enough, not making the full-throated argument on behalf of sexual freedom that is necessary, for, you know, kind of only willing to, in a kind of abstemious way, fight for a kind of freedom of sexual expression that ultimately upholds a regime of heteronormativity instead of contests it. So anyway, that's kind of where the sex radical feminists are coming from. They're unsatisfied with the kind of sexual politics of the cultural left, because they see it as patriarchal and sexist. They are like unsatisfied with the sexual politics of kind of more mainstream post-war liberalism, because they see it as like stultifying and heteronormative, and they are trying to enunciate a kind of alternative vision of sexual freedom. Why they decide to get into bed with the civil libertarians, as I said, I think they want to win, because the anti-pornography feminist movement is like gaining a lot of steam. Like, you know, anti-pornography feminist leaders, like the leaders of anti-pornography feminist organizations, are like on the Phil Donahue show and shit, right? They are now championing this model ordinance. It is being considered in like Suffolk County, New York, and in Minnesota, and in Indianapolis, and some places in California, right? It's kind of getting taken seriously. And they want to strike back. And so they make common cause with other groups who oppose the Dworkin-McKinnon ordinance, like all these anti-censorship civil libertarian groups, like the American Booksellers Association. And they write a legal brief, an amicus brief, in the court case challenging the Indianapolis version of the Dworkin-McKinnon ordinance. It's called the Fact Brief. The Feminist Anti-Censorship Task Force is this kind of ad hoc group that these sex radicals form to fight the Dworkin-McKinnon ordinance. And this legal brief, you know, you do see, I do a like kind of close reading of it in the book, you see some of those core sex radical feminist values reflected in it. They are making arguments that are quite different from the arguments that, you know, the ACLU or whatever is filing in this case. But, you know, as Nan Hunter, who's one of the authors of the Fact Brief, says, right, they were very strategically, she writes this in retrospect, looking back at what they were doing. She's like, we were very strategically trying to drape our very controversial position in the kind of more acceptable, palatable robes of, you know, good old First Amendment, free speech, as American as apple pie kind of language, right? And you still see this today. I was talking with somebody who's like very much involved in, you know, kind of the professional organization for actors and in pornographic films, which now I'm forgetting it, but it's like their advocacy group, their lobbying group. And it's called like the Free Speech Association or something like that, right? So, you know, you have people who are definitely sexual outlaws in all kinds of ways. They make their living by doing like double anal, right? And yet their professional association is kind of draped in this much more palatable, kind of more broadly socially acceptable version of kind of mainstream liberalism, right? The Free Speech Association or something like that, right? So, you know, you still see this kind of game being played, and I understand, right? If I were Nan Hunter and Sylvia Law, right, I would have probably done the same thing, because those arguments are going to be much more legally persuasive. They're going to be much more persuasive of the broader general public if you're trying to win that war of public opinion than the kind of arguments that, you know, the leather dykes in Samoa are making, right? So I get politically, historically, why they do that. But I am, as a denizen of the 21st century who has to live in with the consequences of that decision, I'm very frustrated, right? Because yeah. I see.
Right. I'm sorry to interrupt. I mean, because it strikes me just on this point that, I mean, it strikes me as somewhat short-term thinking, because it seems to me in an alternative universe, the sex radical feminists could have allied with the anti-pornography feminists and said something like, yes, McKinnon and Dworkin, we want to, you know, eliminate that form of pornography, because that's the kind of form of pornography that's super heteronormative and mm-hmm. subordinates women.
Yeah.
So let's write into your ordinance that, you know, a civil rights legislation against forms of pornography that subordinate women, which would allow for forms of, again, graphic depictions of sex that are more egalitarian in nature. I'm curious as to why that wasn't an option, or maybe are members of this group sort of, did they look back and regret that decision?
Oh, no.
No, okay, all right.
I write about the sex force like they're a thing in the past, but they are very much, Gail Rubin, who's, you know, major combatant in this stuff, writes the paper Thinking Sex, that becomes, you know, again, like a kind of canonical work of queer theory, sexuality studies. But, you know, she writes it in the context of the Barnard Conference and all this. So, you know, Gail Rubin, this was maybe, oh, I don't know, I'll get the year wrong. I was still in graduate school, so maybe it was like 2013 or something. GLQ did a special issue, like a retrospective on the Barnard Conference, this big flashpoint in the sex wars. And Gail Rubin writes a reflection essay, right? And the title of that essay is Blood Under the Bridge, you know, which I think is illustrative of the extent to which the wounds sustained across feminist lines in these conflicts are still very much, you know, with the people who were involved in these conflicts, right? So no, there's no kind of wistful looking back and regretting, right? It's a sort of like, you know, and again, like, I'm not judging it. I would in all likelihood feel very much the same way, right? A kind of real bitterness, right? Real enmity still, I think, persists.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm curious as to whether that, though, could be a live option that could be a reconciliatory point in the future, right?
I think so. Yeah. Right. And, you know, I think that this is an opportunity that my generation of feminists has open for us, right? Because we were not direct parties to these conflicts. Those wounds are not ours. And perhaps there are opportunities for reframing and forging alternative coalitions and alliances that for, you know, all kinds of good, legitimate reasons were just not available to feminists then, right?
Yeah, good. So let's talk about your last chapter before we get to the conclusion. Here you discuss the, you know, more paths not taken, importantly with the exclusion of feminists, theorists of color and third world feminists from the discussion. You know, it's not as if there weren't any members of these groups as part of this discussion. There were, but they've been excluded from the discussion. So I thought maybe you could, you know, pick a few examples of these theorists and discuss what you take to be, you know, contributions that could have maybe changed the way this debate could have gone.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, the real like heroine of my book is Cherry Moraga. Cherry Moraga, of course, you know, poet, acclaimed editor and contributor to This Bridge Called My Back, this real groundbreaking anthology of collections of writing by feminist women of color. She was very involved in the sex wars and sex radical feminism. And at every turn, Moraga was trying to explain to her sex radical feminist comrades the kind of limited and exclusionary nature of their, you know, kind of sex radical feminist vanguardism. She's a Chicana, and she's also like queer and embraces at least at the time, a kind of BDSM identity and is involved in those kinds of circles. So she feels she has a stake in the sex radical feminist crusade. She aligns herself with those groups and communities. She attends the Barnard Conference and participates in it. She participates in the post-conference speak out about politically incorrect sex. But if you look at the substance of her contributions, you can see that what she is trying to do is to kind of, again, like in a kind of Socratic gadfly way, right, show the kind of limitations of what these predominantly white sex radical feminists are doing. And she is in particular pushing for, I think, more of the kind of coalition with potentially feminists on the anti-pornography side, right? She's really blurring that boundary. She once she may even use this metaphor at one point in her comments at the Speak Out. She wants feminists to kind of lay down their arms and talk to each other about sex, right? And you know, she thinks that she really laments that there haven't been those spaces where feminists can come together and speak more openly about their various sexual perspectives and sexual experiences. And she hopes that the Barnard Conference or like sex radical feminist spaces can be those spaces, but she's very disappointed and kind of heartbroken when she finds that they are not. So yeah, it's like at the Barnard Conference, she stands up and, you know, she basically says like, look, like I was invited to speak at the Speak Out. I was not told it was gonna be a kind of coming out party for all these S&M dykes. Although I love and respect my S&M dykes and like kind of low key, like I'm one of you. I was hoping for this to be about more than just celebrating our perverse, subversive, vanguardist sexual identities and practices. I thought we were gonna really talk about our sexual desires and aspirations as women of different races, women of different cultural backgrounds. But instead it's this very kind of like, it's this event that's kind of centered on a kind of white feminist need to feel affirmed in their queer sexual identity, which for Baraga, like she needs more than just that, right? And if we make sex radical feminists simply about celebrating deviance, as Mirtha Quintanalis, another third world feminist, says at the Barnard Conference, if that's all we're doing, we're actually cutting ourselves off from communities of women of color specifically, right? Who are gonna be really either kind of turned off and alienated by this kind of celebration of deviance, or who are just not gonna find it all that meaningful and relevant, because that's not what they're, that's not the sexual oppression that they're fighting. So, you know, that's just one example of a kind of intervention that these third world women, feminists of color make, where they are trying to see those synergies and those opportunities to make common cause with I think anti-pornography feminists, or feminists who are a little more skeptical and critical of, you know, for example, how structures, including kind of mental psychological structures of racism, might inform something like BDSM. Maraca seems very open to having that conversation, right? Very open to taking that kind of critical vantage point on BDSM, where it had kind of become a party line amongst sex radical feminism to dismiss those kinds of critiques as just rooted in, you know, kind of prejudice or squeamishness about BDSM sexuality. Maraca seems eager to have those discussions. So, you know, she's trying to forge these potential alliances. And yet she's also kind of pushing, I think, sex radical feminists to do more and to see the limitations of their kind of celebration of deviance. She's also, she should take credit for what I think is the main contribution of my book, to see how liberalism drove the kind of carceral turn in some of these feminist projects, right? She kind of sees that happening in real time and does her best to name it in those remarks at the Barnard Conference, right? When our position is reduced to a kind of demanding my right to be free to do what I want, because we have these anti-pornography feminists who are coming at us, you know, and we are kind of standing our ground and saying, I have the right to do whatever I want. You can't tell me what to do. She's like, that's like such a limited sexual politics. And I thought sex radical feminism was supposed to be about more than just kind of, you know, my civil liberties or something like that. So anyway, that's one example I would highlight from that chapter of how feminists of color were really trying to do something richer and different.
Right. Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah, okay. So I was curious about what carceral politics meant. So that it refers to a, you know, a form of politics that emphasizes liberal rights, right? Negative freedom rather than a responsibility positively to do something. Is that roughly?
I think that all that cashes out in an ultimately kind of carceral politics. But what carceral feminism kind of means is like a feminism that figures criminal justice solutions as appropriate to remedy the harms that, you know, like sexual injustice and sexual oppression, right? So, you know, rape is, there's a pandemic of rape on college and university campuses. What we need is a kind of like law enforcement crackdown, right? Stricter enforcement of, you know, these student codes of conduct, or you know, that we can kind of like arrest and prosecute and incarcerate our way to sexual freedom would be a kind of carceral feminist approach. And my argument is once feminist sexual politics is kind of watered down into a kind of slightly modified version of a conventional liberal sexual politics, is that kind of leaves it, like it's not inoculated against carceral feminist temptation, right? That, because if you think about it, like for liberalism, it's so squeamish about state power and so committed to the principle of limited government, that it's very hard to justify the liberal state intervening in anything short of a crime, right? It has to be kind of figured as, you know, a violation of somebody's rights, you know, kind of aggression, right, is often the language that libertarians will use. You've aggressed against my rights. And now the state, in its role as kind of neutral umpire, can step in and punish you for breaking those rules. So like the kind of criminal justice powers of the state are like the only tool you have to work with, right? Once you're in that kind of limited liberal conceptual space. So that's what I mean when I say once feminism is attenuated to a kind of reprogramming of liberalism, unless it surrenders its commitment to doing something about sexual injustice, which then it would cease to be feminism, right? Its kind of only tool is to like try to frame sexual injustice as crime and invite the liberal state in to kind of punish it. So that's how I see liberalism and carceral feminism kind of working in this symbiotic way.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that helps clarify for me that, you know, so you're, I mean, to just to ask a question, I guess, about this, the part of what you're doing in this chapter is answering the question of the book, as it were, why we lost the sex wars. And so, you know, this sort of, I think, you know, touches on it squarely. I mean, one of the things you say is this sort of the monistic character of the way that the debate turned. I was wondering if you could sort of say more about the sort of monism of it, because it, I mean, I can understand the monism in the way that you were just describing, which is this a kind of monistic approach to politics. That is, that to conceive of politics simply as a rights-based exercise, and that plays right into liberal hands. But also I get the sense that you are also in this chapter thinking of monism in a, you know, kind of, you know, race-based way. That is, this is, you know, it's about concerns about rich white people, right? Is that, and so it's monistic and flattening in that way. So maybe you could say, you know, do you have both in mind as sort of explanations for, you know, how we lost the sex war, as it were, or is it one or the other?
Yeah, so I borrow this language of monism from a feminist theorist, Deborah King. You know, it's often, right, it's commonplace today to talk about like intersectionality and intersectional feminism. But then the question becomes like, well, what's the antonym? Like, what do we call a feminism that isn't intersectional? And some people call it white feminism, and you know, I suppose that's okay. But I like Deborah King's kind of formulation. She describes a kind of feminism that is oriented only toward a kind of single axis of oppression, the oppression women experience on account of their gender. She names that as a kind of monistic politics. And, you know, same for like anti-racist politics that like a kind of Black nationalist politics that is focused solely on the oppression Black people experience on account of their race, right? And therefore overlooks the oppression, for example, Black women experience on account of their gender. That would be a kind of monistic anti-racist politics. So I kind of borrow Deborah King's language there because I think it's helpful to have a name to call the opposite of intersectional feminism, and I call it kind of monistic, right? And yeah, I think that when you look at the anti-pornography feminism, and I do this in the book, like a kind of close reading of Andrea Dworkin's anti-pornography feminism, it's pretty monistic. She talks about race. It's at least on her radar for other examples of anti-pornography feminism I briefly discuss in the book, right? That's not even in their political conceptual universe to think about how porn might contribute to racial inequality, but at least Dworkin is kind of trying to think that through. But ultimately, like the conclusion Dworkin draws is pornography is oppressive to Black women in the same way pornography is oppressive to white women, just worse, right? So Black women in pornography are represented as kind of the lowliest of the low of women, right? So they're kind of gendered in a way in pornography that situates them politically vis-a-vis men in an even worse off way than white women, right? So that's kind of Andrea Dworkin's analysis of what the work race does in pornography. And it's like a very monistic analysis. It says that the kind of oppression that Black women experience through pornography is the same, just worse, as the oppression white women experience. Well, like what non-monistic anti-pornography feminists, or what we might think of as like intersectional anti-pornography feminists, like Alice Walker, do is they refine that, right? They say, actually, like if you look at the way in which Black women are represented in pornography, there's kind of more going on there, right? So one observation they make is like, it's often the case that like Black women aren't represented in pornography or are represented in pornography significantly less, right? So they're less likely than white women to be held out as sort of suitable, appropriate objects of male sexual desire. And that's a kind of inequality, right? Another, you know, kind of insight that they have is like Black women in pornography they're represented as like objects of disgust, which can have a kind of erotic component to it, right? So when you want to kind of cater to a kind of erotic interest in the putrid, the vile, the disgusting, you do that through the body of a Black woman in a way that you don't do it through the body of a white woman. So they would say there's a kind of qualitative difference in terms of how Black women are represented in pornography and white women are represented in pornography. This is kind of like not on Andrea Dworkin's more monistic radar, right? Another really, this to me is the most important insight from you know, the Black and Third World feminists and who are involved in the anti-pornography movement like Alice Walker. They think that pornography oppresses Black men, which, you know, for Andrea Dworkin is sort of anathema almost, right? I think her view is, you know, pornography, you know, kind of caters to the preferences and kind of puffs up the ego and solidifies the personalities and, you know, in all these ways of men, all men, invites Black men the kind of opportunity to be identified with white male patriarchal power in the form of what she calls the bribe. But I won't go into that. But, you know, Alice Walker's point is like, she actually views pornography as sort of inviting Black men to participate in their own racial subordination because they are masturbating to images that represent Blackness as vile, as abject, as disgusting. They are sort of fantasizing themselves out of their Blackness to indulge this fantasy, is sort of Alice Walker's read. And so there's this kind of alienation that is happening to Black men through pornography, which sort of undermines the potential for intra-racial, intergender political solidarity between Black men and Black women. So there's this kind of theorization of how pornography undermines anti-racist work across gender, anti-racial, anti-racist coalitions and stuff, which is like, again, even the anti-pornography feminists who talk about race and pornography, they don't arrive at that kind of insight.
Good, yeah. So I wanted to get to your conclusion before we run out of time here, because in the conclusion you discuss a couple, you know, contemporary examples, the slut walk, trigger warnings, kind of return to the Me Too movement. I wanted to invite you kind of here in the conclusion to sort of discuss, you know, what I take to be the ultimate conclusion of the book, which is something like this, and correct me if I'm wrong, which is I take it one of the things that you were doing is arguing that, you know, liberalism has in a sense sort of appropriated or domesticated this sure. discussion, distorted it, maybe is a better way to put it. And your effort here is to sort of, you know, recover a kind of more radical roots of the of this debate. Again, as a liberal myself, my own inclination would be to develop a more expansive view of liberalism, because I think, you know, for example, Republican forms of liberalism will emphasize principles like non-domination, which you could extend to pornography. But in any case, I don't know if we want to go down that road, but
Philip kind of does some of that.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And that's kind of what I had. I mean, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. I mean, it strikes me that a more expansive and robust form of liberalism could get what you want, but maybe, I don't know what you think.
this like takes me beyond the scope of the book, but
right. That's what I like to do in this show.
No, it kind of takes me deep into my like own like personal whatever axes to grind or whatever. Like, you know, I would maybe object to characterizing, you know, Republicanism as an expanded form of liberalism, right? I would see that as, you know, limiting the kind of critical potential of a Republican perspective. Now, what I think specifically of Pettit, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to like, I don't know if characterizing his project as, you know, trying to expand liberalism or anyway, it gets into this kind of messy stuff where, you know, but I, you know, I'm very much persuaded that one of the main values of the kind of Republican revival that we've seen in our discipline over the past several decades is it's like another alternative to liberalism, please, please, as many alternatives to liberalism as we can have. It's all helpful. It all is so much fodder for a kind of radical, critical political imagination that I think is so important.
Okay, that's good. All right, so with that digression,
cards on the table,
right? Okay, so I can get on board too. Yeah, so I mean, maybe you could talk a little bit about some of these, you know, pick an example or two, you know, and discuss, you know, the way in which liberalism hamstrings some of these discussions, and maybe way in which you know, kind of a recovery of more of these radical roots can take these examples in a different direction.
I'm sorry, could you ask it one more time?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of your examples of slut walk and trigger warnings. Maybe if you could, you know, pick one of those examples and talk about what kind of the, you know, what you take to be how the book might inform those particular examples and be a way to kind of take them forward in a different way.
Yeah. So I'll talk about trigger warnings first. You know, there was, again, this kind of like hysterical response to, you know, demands for trigger warnings on college and university campuses. And this was all happening as I was working on the dissertation. And this was part of that like Christmas effects feeling, you know, where, you know, my initial thought was like a trigger warning is such like a trivial request. And that's what it's a request, right? Very rarely do these take the form of kind of like mandatory policies, like you must include a trigger warning or else. It's sort of like a request for the courtesy of notifying me in advance if I am going to watch some, you know, potentially triggering scene of like sexual violence, or, you know, or I'm thinking right now I'm teaching an LGBTQ politics course and we're reading this book about the kind of ex-gay movement and conversion therapy. And, you know, like I should probably give my students like a heads up, hey, there's going to be vivid descriptions of, you know, what you kind of spiritual abuse you yourself may have experienced, and this may be disturbing, right? You know, so that's kind of what a trigger warning is. It's like a little request for a courtesy of a heads up before, you know, I have to be exposed to something that could be potentially distressing, right? It seems like the smallest, most insignificant thing, right? And yet there's this kind of hysterical response of like, oh, how illiberal and academic freedom and yada, yada, yada. And, you know, to me, all that concern and anxiety was just so misplaced. I'm both disappointed in the kind of that student activism became so focused and fixated on the trigger warning demand, because it's such, again, like a kind of trivial thing, right? And then I'm equally disappointed in the kind of hysterical response to it, right? It's like, come on, can we please fight over things that matter, right? Controversial things, can we just fight over controversial things instead of utterly banal, non-controversial things? So that's kind of my take on the trigger warning stuff, is like that if we were to tap into some of the radical traditions that have been clouded over by the catfight narrative, we might be able to imagine a more transformative responses to rape culture on college campuses than trigger warnings. That's, you know, I think in a nutshell, my shtick there.
Yeah, I mean, I was curious, maybe we can finish with this question, which is what's your take on campus politics in this sense? I mean, do you think that, you know, student activism is, you know, hamstrung by this narrative and by a kind of liberal approach, or do you think that it's already sort of taking a kind of feminist politics in transformative ways? Are you sort of optimistic about the way that campus politics are going, or are you more on the pessimistic side?
I'm pessimistic in that I'm not convinced how much longer there'll be campuses. Or universities, or, you know, so like deeply pessimistic in that respect. No, I mean, I think that I wrote my book to invite more expansive thinking about what we feminists might do vis-a-vis sexual oppression, sexual injustice, sexual abuse. Like that's my goal, right? And I was kind of pessimistic that I wasn't convinced that was going to be happening, and I wanted to provoke people to do it, or at least clear the ground so that we could embark on that, you know, kind of declutter the space of this unproductive, stultifying catfight narrative. I will say I'm optimistic in that I don't think I'm the only, you know, kind of millennial feminist or whatever who's interested in this, right? This Oxford philosopher, Amiya Srinivasan, just came out with this book, right? The Right to Sex. And, you know, I see, I haven't spoken with her. I don't know if she would see it this way, but, you know, I kind of see us as involved in kind of kindred work, right? Of trying to retrieve, well, first, like, just being willing to look back and take seriously the positions articulated in the course of the feminist sex wars. And then trying to retrieve from that history critical insights that can be valuable for us today, right? So, you know, I'm like a fan of what she's doing, and there are other, you know, examples I could point to of, I think, people who are kind of experiencing the same dissatisfactions and frustrations and concerns about carceral feminism that I am, and who are open to re-examining and reconsidering some of these ideas from the past that might be illuminating and productive. So I'm optimistic in that regard.
Good. I'm happy to hear that. I'm glad to end on that maybe happy note. Lorna, it's been a pleasure. Thank you again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me. And as I said at the outset, before you press the red button, thank you so much for creating the space for political theorists to nerd out together in a way that's hopefully a little more accessible than the other ways we nerd out together.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.